This podcast is for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to January's Rich Pickings, Fidelity's Asset Allocation Podcast. I'm Richard Edgar, Editor-in-Chief, and with me are some of the multi-asset team all set to take 2018 by the horns and armed with their New Year resolutions. Now, we're recording this towards the end of January, so I wonder whether any have lasted the month. Let's find out. Joining me are markets analyst Charlotte Harrington, who will be
aiming to take up ballroom dancing again.
Aiming to, I like that, full of confidence. There's time yet before the end of the month. Portfolio manager Bill McQuaker is determined to
remember that nothing lasts forever. In life, where I'm going to try and be more healthy, and in markets, where I'm not going to forget that you need portfolio hedges.
Oh, what a well-rounded answer. Thank you very much indeed for that. And James Bateman, Chief Investment Officer of Multi-Asset, resolved to
travel to some more interesting places this year and not just go to the same old ones year in, year out.
So where's new?
Well, most of the world, if I'm honest, because I'm a creature of habit, but I might be in Warsaw in a few weeks, for example, so that would be an exciting place to visit.
An interesting place to go. Thank you very much indeed, and welcome to all of you. Well, James and Bill, I'd like to start with the two of you, if I may, because this month's Asset Allocation Group meeting was a particularly intriguing dissection of where you all sit in relation to the market's extended bull run. The general consensus, I think, was one which remains risk on. But Bill, while you continue to be overweight in equities, you're a bit more cautious than James about the timing of any changes. Is that fair?
I am. And my starting point is perhaps slightly bizarrely, I acknowledge the bull case in its entirety. There's a lot of good stuff happening in the world today. Whether it's to do with growth or interest rates and inflation or lack of volatility. Yeah, these are the forces that are driving markets upwards. My concern is, like in life, nothing lasts forever. And so I worry that with such a high level of commitment to risk in markets, if you look at investors' positioning, they've embraced risk in a very meaningful way the last 2 years. And if you look at appetite for equities for a long time, I believe the notion that we're climbing a wall of worry. But the most recent survey data suggests that people don't think the equity market's going to go down again for a long time.
Which is scary.
There was an embedded belief equities too dangerous, vulnerable to going down. That's faded over the last 12 or 18 months. And so I'm concerned that if we were to see US inflation surprise to the upside, surprise to the downside last year, then that perhaps something as simple as that on its own could set up a market that's more volatile, and more market volatility, I think, would make it a lot harder for these ongoing gains to continue.
It's perhaps a question of nuance, though, James. Perhaps you don't disagree with Bill, but you haven't got the same sense of foreboding right now. Is that right?
It's a reasonably fair summary, Richard. Yes, thank you. So I think that from my point of view, I guess there are two things. One is, yes, all the preconditions for a continued bull market are there. And whenever they are there, you also have a lot of risks that could derail that. As a bluntly rational individual and investor, you could look at the market now and say, market's run far enough, now is the time not to be in equities. The problem with that is that the period of excess optimism, euphoria, etc., that characterizes a late bull market can be several years, and we are reasonably early in that journey. So yes, it could end today or tomorrow or next week, or it could end in 2 or 3 years' time, and it's very hard to know which. So my view is, one, as long as you're seeing strong positive momentum with strong economic data and strong macro indicators, reducing your risk on position feels dangerous. And secondly, even if you do see a correction, which I think it could be quite a nasty correction, my sense is it's a buying opportunity that still remains at the beginning of the last leg of the bull market.
So even if there is a drop, there's more of a run still to
That's
go.
That's my view, yes.
Charlotte, you're looking at the data that James is referring to all the time. Do you agree? Do you think that this is simply rosy and it's too soon to start taking things away?
Yeah, I think the fundamentals in terms of the economic data are certainly supportive and plays to a lot of what both Bill and James are saying. It is also true that sentiment is incredibly overbought and has been for a number of weeks, and I'm not just talking about price action. I'm talking about this low volatility environment, and surveys around sort of bulls versus bears and things like that. These are looking quite extreme, and you overlay that onto the start of the year in which equity markets have broken a number of records in terms of starting the year with a bang, and I think it does argue for a short-term pause or at least some caution into sort of buying into this up move.
Okay, but we are still in the throes of a growing market at the moment. Is the market going to look the same, whether it's another month or another year or another 2 or 3 years? Is it going to be the same players that are doing well? Which sectors or even which individual stocks, if you look at things like the FANGs?
I think we're already seeing some signs that markets are showing some appetite for the laggards. So the energy sector is the outstanding example of this. The middle of last year, you couldn't give energy stocks away in the United States, and the oil price was falling despite the fact that conditions in the oil markets, certainly in our judgment, was improving. Fast forward 6 or 7 months, and it's changed a lot. Charlotte was talking about markets making new highs. Maybe the oil price hasn't made a new high in absolute terms, but certainly in the context of the last 2 or 3 years, the oil price has moved up very significantly, and assets in equity markets are responding to that. And we've seen very strong performance from derivatives of the oil price over the last 4 or 5 months. And frankly, I find that somewhat reassuring. It suggests that it's not just a momentum story in markets.
There is more underlying it, Charlotte.
I think actually a critical question for us at this point is going to be around the US dollar, and the dollar weakness has been very supportive of that commodity price move. It's also meant that even as yields have climbed higher, some of the traditionally yield sensitive areas of the market have stayed quite strong because it's been somewhat offset by this lower dollar. And for me, that really is going to be very, very important, and a lot of that's going to depend on what the central banks do and how quickly they start to change stance in reaction to some of these inflationary pressures.
And is this the beginning of a rotation? Are we seeing a very different character that we should expect, in the next few, the next period? I don't want to put time on it.
Richard, I think it's too early to tell. And to my mind, in a way, that doesn't matter. Playing the idea of a switch in leadership is very attractive. It's attractive for two reasons. One is, if the market continues to go up, all other things being equal, you'd expect at some point those stocks to catch up, and therefore there's real upside versus the broad market. Secondly, if we're wrong in our thesis and the market starts falling, these are the stocks that haven't moved up so much. So actually, they're actually going to be the more defensive stocks. So either way, even if you're wrong in your overall thesis, it's a way of actually protecting your returns.
Yeah, and I think that notion at this stage of the economic and market cycle, finding positions that offer that each way character, I think is extremely helpful to investors.
A type of hedge, I suppose, in a way. Now, what about volatility? A couple of you have mentioned it. I mean, it's so low given the stage of the cycle that we probably haven't seen anything like this for decades. Bill?
Well, the most recent comparison is probably with the famous Great Moderation in 2005-6-7, when financial market volatility was very becalmed and people saw it as evidence of a new economic paradigm. Gordon Brown characterised it best. The end of boom and bust was his proud claim.
Turned out to be quite so proud.
turned out to be a little way wide of the mark. Another interesting comparison is with Japan in the late 1980s. The Japanese stock market famously peaked at 40,000 in December 1989. The volatility of the Japanese equity market running up to that historic peak, today we're somewhere north of 20,000, so 25 years later, we still haven't got back. Very little volatility in Japanese equities. So I don't think that we can be completely reassured about the future by observing that there is little volatility in markets today. And if we're to nuance it just a touch, in 2018, we've seen a very modest pickup in volatility in fixed income, in equities, and some evidence of shorting of some of the big fixed income ETFs in the US. I'm thinking high yield and credit. Interesting development.
James?
So, I think, when you think about volatility, it is abnormally and irrationally low, given where valuations are, given where the world is inevitably, therefore, you expect at some point volatility to climb, and it would be very odd actually to hit the end of a bull market without volatility climbing. I think the market will react very badly to a material move up in volatility, and I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One is the volume of money that is invested to bet on low volatility, and therefore material moves up in volatility will mean that money starts coming off the table, getting a vicious circle of volatility spiking. The second is, of course, financial regulation, particularly in the EU, requires that financial institutions bucket assets by risk. And if volatility really starts moving up, that can make some of them forced sellers of certain assets. And again, that begets higher volatility and higher volatility. So there are reasons to think once the volatility genie is out of its bottle, it really is out. But and I think that could be a messy few months in markets where it's hard to know where things are going to land. I also think it could be a very attractive buying opportunity.
And triggered, interestingly, by regulation. So,
well, it's one of the triggers, yes.
Okay. Now, low volatility is part of the Goldilocks phenomenon, along with low inflation, low rates, the continued economic growth. People are just willing it on, aren't they, James?
Absolutely. And you know, I have a very simple view on how the market is in terms of Goldilocks, which is basically that the market participants are a Goldilocks, which would say, I think all three beds are comfortable, I think all three porridges are at the right temperature or good enough temperature. Whatever they're given, they're actually saying, this is good enough, I'm happy. And so the definition of the sweet spot is wrong. There's no sweet spot, it's almost anything. So, you know, whatever data comes through, the market is saying that's good, we're happy with it, and that's kind of sits within the kind of framework of that's a reason for risk assets to keep moving upwards. So yes, so I think the market is almost desperate to self-sustain a bull market through eternal optimism. That's not a good thing, because clearly when that turns, that becomes very messy. But almost every bit of data being seen is positive. And I think if we see a situation in which inflation creeps up, central banks either tighten or don't, all of those scenarios, the market's going to say is good.
I think if we think about where Goldilocks, or what Goldilocks was initially, it was this sort of mediocre growth, low inflation environment. And so what we've seen more recently is this increase in the inflation break even, but those real yields have maintained their level and been quite anchored. The question is, are markets going to redefine Goldilocks as Goldilocks the second, in which strong growth and strong inflation still remains a good environment for equities? And I think there's still a question mark over that.
So I think over whether they would define it, redefine it, or whether it is still good for equities.
Or whether they will redefine Goldilocks the second as something that is still good for equities, but is characterised by slightly different things, which is a higher real rate and a higher inflation rate.
And I think they will, but I think the challenge is, I think they will also do that if inflation is high and growth begins to peter out.
Well, let's turn to inflation there, because one of our research analysts, Ian Sampson, has been warning of a spike in inflation, saying it might be closer than many think, and it's largely down to the price of oil, something, Bill, that you talked about a little bit earlier. Well, we stopped by Ian's desk to hear what he had to say.
The obvious question is, will oil keep rallying? We see $70 as perfectly reasonable, given the strong economic backdrop. But actually, any higher than this and you get quite an aggressive reaction from quite flexible shale producers in the US that sort of caps prices. So we don't see things getting out of hand. So we think 70, sticking around here, is probably a reasonable expectation. But that would take us well above central banks' 2% inflation targets in the US, Eurozone, and keep us well above target in the UK. So what does this mean? Central banks will have to tighten policy, ending reversing quantitative easing, raising interest rates, gradually but surely.
Well, that's Ian in the middle of the fevered activity of the multi-asset team's area. But Bill, first of all, is Ian right? Is inflation on the way?
I think it probably is. I think it's difficult to put an order of magnitude on it, but the what the Ian's referencing suggests that we could, in terms of headline inflation, be above the central bank's targets by the end of this year and into next year. I think that's a headwind. I worry about these type of developments in the sense that I see them as the price for growth. We talked earlier about this super Goldilocks, where growth isn't just mundane, it's actually good, but nevertheless inflation stays low and the central banks stay on hold. I don't think the market is working towards that. I think the market's fully embraced it. The problem is, what happens if we start to shake some of those pillars because there's actually a bit too much growth in the world and the oil price goes higher and inflation rates go higher and central banks have to respond. I think the door is opening to that scenario it's something that I find quite troubling.
Would central banks have to respond? I mean, this is an interesting point, isn't it?
This is where I think Bill and I disagree. I am of the view that central banks are going to be consciously late to the party on tightening. And I think there are two main reasons for that. Number one is that from a purely intellectual basis, inflation has been below target for the best part of a decade. It can run above target for the best part of a decade and on a 20-year view still be on target. So I think central banks can rationalise it that way if they so desire.
Politically, it'd be very hard to stomach, though.
Well, I think politically it'd be very easy to stomach because actually if you're... A government, be you a populist government or a government trying to see off a populist rival, there are a couple of benefits to inflation. One is it reduces the aggregate debt level, very helpful. But secondly, there's this massive concern around inequality and that's creating a lot of political pressure. And there's always this focus on wage inequality. The issue isn't wage inequality. The issue is wealth inequality. And a lot of those wealth assets are in either property or low-risk assets whose value will be substantially eroded by a period of inflation. So actually, you can redress some of the imbalances in the world and some of the imbalances that have political consequences through allowing inflation. The risk there, of course, is when you allow inflation to go above target for a period of time, inflation tends to get out of control. So at some point down the line, that requires a very rapid ramping up of interest rates to choke it off. But that's a way away.
The other genie in the bottle. Yeah.
But even without that ramping up of rates eventually, I think James is still describing a world in which the PE multiple on equity markets finds it much harder to expand. And we've enjoyed actually a wonderful period the last 18 months where earnings growth and PE multiple expansion has driven equity markets higher. If we are going to see central banks tolerate higher rates of inflation above target for a period of time, then I think the likelihood is that multiple expansion just disappears out of the equation. And we saw something akin to this in the mid-1960s when after a long period of very low inflation, very little wage inflation, inflation rates started to pick up and equity markets found it much harder to get traction against that backdrop. Because equities, although they're somewhat hedged against inflation, that doesn't mean they like inflation. They become a much more attractive asset than certainly fixed income. Probably more attractive than other low-risk assets that James is referencing. But I don't think it's an environment where you make the same outsized gains as we've enjoyed in recent history.
Charlotte?
Well, I'll add to that. I didn't think necessarily that this is a case of whether or not central banks will allow inflation to hit beyond their targets. I actually have the view that they are already in that camp, to use the phrase, behind the curve. I mean, if you look at Europe, they're still using extraordinary emergency levels of monetary policy, and growth is incredibly strong and inflation is rising, and arguably they're already behind the curve, and it's going to be that shift from them moving from non-emergency measures to more normal measures which could see the disruption that we're sort of referring to.
So a return to normality scaring the horses and triggering something else.
Yeah, and to some extent they're already trying to do this very carefully and they're already being cautious with their messaging, but you know, ultimately they are going to get there if conditions remain as they are. And that, I think, is a headwind both for rates and for equities.
Interesting, this idea of allowing inflation to rise to erode the value of debt, to erode the value of houses, to make them more affordable. There's a lot of politicians who perhaps be happy with that.
Exactly.
Okay, well, I think we're out of time, but not before we play the game Hotcakes and Hot Potatoes. What's selling like hotcakes? What would you drop like a hot potato? Bill, let me come to you first.
My hotcake is gold.
Why?
Because I think that in the environment we've been discussing, a bit more inflation, but no, on balance, probably not a disaster. I think gold goes quite well. If, on the other hand, we're a bit too optimistic about the world and we turn risk off, then I think, like in the first half of 2016, gold catches a bid and maybe quite a strong bid against that much more uncertain outlook.
And your hot potato?
My hot potato is another lower risk asset, but one that I think is much less well placed in the environment we've been discussing, and that's credit. I think more inflation, possibility of higher interest rates, inflation pressing on companies' P&Ls, that's not a great environment for credit. So, I think that's the area I'd avoid.
Great. Okay, Charlotte.
I can say my hot cake is the Canadian dollar. It has moved quite a long way, but I think over the course of the year that can continue.
And
well, the fundamentals there are very strong. You've got very low unemployment there, and the central bank really have focused on trade discussions. And provided those don't end up as a total disaster, then I think Canada can continue to do well.
And your hot potato?
Hot potato is the discretionary sector. Consumers tend to do worse when rates are rising and oil prices are rising, and discretionary tends to fit that narrative.
If rates go up, see above. Jolly good. And James, your hot cake.
So I think my hot cake is inflation-linked bonds, and in particular, probably emerging market linkers, because we've set out the case for inflation, and EM linkers particularly have a higher sensitivity to short-term moves in inflation.
And your hot potato?
My hot potato, and I've said this before, is cash, because I just do not see the case for owning cash as other than as a transactional asset. It's particularly if you're in the UK, its value is being eroded massively by inflation at the moment, and the idea that you can't find something that does better than a up to 3% loss of purchasing power a year would be quite depressing. So
there's nothing more than a few lost coins underneath the Bateman mattress.
Hopefully not many lost coins, but yes.
Absolutely. Okay, well, we're out of time. I hope that's given you an insight into the thinking behind this month's asset allocation. If you'd like more detail, it's published in full on our website, and if you'd like to discuss anything we've covered, just ask your Fidelity contacts. Thanks very much indeed to my guests, Charlotte, James and Bill, and thanks to you for listening. We'll be back next month, but for now, goodbye.
This podcast is for investment professionals only and should not be relied on by private investors. This podcast is provided for information purposes only and is intended only for the person or entity to which it is sent. It must not be reproduced or circulated to any other party without prior permission of Fidelity. The value of investments can go down as well as up, so you may get back less than you invest. For other important legal notices, please see our website or the Fidelity SoundCloud or iTunes apps.